Welcome to the Shortwave Report for July 6, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, The Voice of Russia, and NHK World Radio Japan. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. At the United Nations, there is a summit to create a treaty to regulate global trade on conventional arms. Germany wants the treaty to include small arms and ammunition. The Italian Prime Minister Monti made it clear that his country is not seeking a financial bailout from the European Union. Radio Deutsche Welle.
Negotiations on a UN treaty to regulate global trade on conventional arms started in New York on Monday. Germany wants the regulations to include the trade of small weapons and ammunition. But it's likely the negotiations will take weeks. Miriam Gerke has this report, which is presented by Nina Hase.
No arms delivery into crisis and conflict regions, weapons exports only when it can be guaranteed they can't be used to commit human rights violations, and when their delivery doesn't threaten the fight against poverty in the receiving countries. These are the so-called golden rules that are the basis on which the 193 UN member states will negotiate their arms trade treaty in New York this month. But even the best rules aren't of much use if they aren't adhered to, says Katharina Spies from Amnesty International Germany.
It's the responsibility of the individual states to guarantee that the golden rules are adhered to. But of course, they concern the exporting states, the importing states, and also the transitory states that are involved in any arms trade.
Amnesty International wants the UN treaty to include criminal sanctions against countries that violate export bans for military equipment.
National states would be in charge. They would have to launch criminal prosecution procedures in the case of illegal arms trade.
At the international conference in New York, Germany wants to push for an effective, legally binding and applicable arms trade treaty. Germany is the third biggest arms exporter after the US and Russia. Last year already, during preliminary negotiations, Germany and other countries called for legally binding minimal standards on the international arms market. But many issues still have until the end of July to be discussed in New York, says Simone Wisotzki. She works for the Hessian Foundation of Peace and Conflict Studies.
There's debate about the question of whether or not to include small arms and light weapons or ammunition, for instance, and also on the whole area of dual-use technology.
Dual-use technology means goods that can be used for both military and civilian purposes. Former UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan once called small arms the true weapons of mass destruction. Close to 900 million such small firearms circulate worldwide. Every minute, one person is shot, with a handgun or a rifle. That's according to estimates by Amnesty International. But negotiations are going to be difficult with the positions of the 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, the US, Russia, China, France and Great Britain.
There are those who insist that arms transfers are every state's sovereign right. Russia and China, for instance. China objects to the human rights clause, but the US also plays an ambivalent role. At least now it's clear that they are in fact going to be part of the negotiations. But we still don't know what the position of the US is going to be regarding whether or not to put ammunition and small arms under the control of the United Nations.
All 193 UN member states will be sitting around the negotiating table in New York. Any agreement requires consensus, warns Simone Wisotzki. And she adds that time is short too. Negotiations will only take 4 weeks.
If we see that the treaty is watered down because of the consensus rule to a degree that it's not even worth the paper it's written on anymore, then we can only hope from a point of view of civil society that those Western states that had pushed for a strong treaty will decide not to sign this version.
Nina Hase, DW.
The Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti has made it clear that his government won't be seeking a bailout from the EU to finance Italy's debt. He made the comment at a joint press conference with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, following a meeting in Rome to discuss troubled Eurozone economies. The talks in the Italian capital were held off the back of an agreement struck by Eurozone leaders at a summit last week to allow the European Stability Mechanism to lend directly to banks. Spain and Italy had held out for this deal at the summit, which was unpopular in Berlin. Merkel came under fire domestically for having caved in on the issue.
Those reports are from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Spanish National Radio. A Spanish court has opened a case against former executives of the lending institution Bankia, while in the UK, Barclays executives were questioned by MPs. Finland and the Netherlands will block the Eurozone's permanent bailout fund from buying bonds in secondary markets. The Greek government is increasing privatization of ports, railway system, and airports. The new French President Hollande moved forward with tax hikes for the richest households and corporations. The European Parliament has rejected ACTA, the global agreement against copyright theft on the Internet. Spanish National Radio.
Here in Spain, a court has opened a case against former executives of lending institution Bankia, which had to be rescued in May and is the entity requiring the largest share of an EU bailout to Spanish banks. Those accused include Rodrigo Rato, former chairman of the bank and one-time IMF chief, who served in the past as a minister under a government led by the center-right People's Party.
Under new management, Bankia, which holds 10% of Spanish deposits, has required a 19 billion euro, or $24 billion, bailout. Bankia's rescue has angered Spaniards who are having to suffer increasingly harsh austerity measures and has triggered a number of demonstrations.
Meanwhile, a day after resigning as chief executive of the British bank Barclays due to the interest rate rigging scandal which shook the entity last week, Bob Diamond faced MPs today in Parliament. There, Mr. Diamond assured MPs that he had no knowledge of interest rate manipulation until this month.
The questioning came following accusations by Barclays that the Bank of England was involved in the rigging, while Prime Minister David Cameron made it clear that it would be completely wrong for outgoing bank executives to receive big payoffs.
Finland and the Netherlands have announced that they will block the Eurozone's permanent bailout fund from buying bonds in secondary markets, despite the agreement reached by European leaders last week that rescue funds be available to stabilize markets. The move was intended to encourage greater fiscal and economic unity within the Union, while also lowering borrowing costs for Spain and Italy. However, the Netherlands and Finland's refusal could threaten the unanimity of the decision. In response, Spain's 10-year yield bonds rose above those of Ireland for the first time, rising to 485 basis points, while the Spanish stock exchange, IBEX 35, managed a meager rise of 0.3%. The Greek government has decided to increase its privatization process in exchange for greater flexibility in the austerity measures required by the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. With this new initiative, the government of Andonis Samaras hope to extend the budget cut deadlines required in return for the bailout they received in 2010. The government hopes to increase the effectiveness of the public sector while cutting red tape and bureaucracy in order to encourage foreign investment.
Horst Reinsbach, chief of the European Commission Work Group, said that such a move would be very important for the future of Greece's economy. He will be meeting today with the Minister of the Merchant Navy to discuss the privatisation of Greek ports. However, the Greek privatisation plan also includes airports, gas facilities, the lottery and the railway system in a Margaret Thatcher-style programme.
In France, François Hollande's new socialist government has introduced tax hikes for the richest households and big corporations, worth 7.2 billion euros, which are meant to help ease France's budget deficit problems. France's debt is currently at 1.8 trillion euros, or 90% of its GDP. Mr. Hollande aims to cut France's public deficit from its current level of 5.2% to 3% by the year 2013.
The new tax regime includes a one-off levy worth 2.3 billion on households earning over 1.3 million euros, and a special tax on large oil companies and banks set to raise 1.1 billion euros. Recently elected President Hollande faces the task of cutting spending while sticking to his electoral promise of not reducing jobs in the process.
The European Parliament has rejected the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, also known as ACTA, a global agreement against copyright theft which would punish people for sharing films and music online. The agreement, which has already been signed by many of the EU's trading partners, faced strong opposition as tens of thousands of activists held rallies across Europe in February to protest against the law, and 2.5 million people signed a petition condemning it.
Martin Scholz, President of the European Parliament, stressed that the EU is not opposed to intellectual property rights, but said that there was a concern that the law could damage people's privacy and civil liberties.
Clashes in northern Peru between police and demonstrators opposing a multi-million dollar gold mining project have left at least three people dead.
Hundreds of people attacked government buildings in the town of Celedín, prompting the authorities to declare a state of emergency in that region. Protesters say the Conga project, financed by US-based company Newmont, will destroy water supplies. Newmont called a temporary halt to work last year after similar protests.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 5 to 6 p.m. at 6055, and podcasting at www.rtve.es. Also, World Radio Network is now podcasting their shows at wrn.org, where you can find lots of international broadcasters. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. Ecuador is considering finally expelling U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, because of the political interference that is financed by the agency. Supporters of ousted President Lugo of Paraguay are continuing to demand that he be reinstated. Three peace activists in New York remained in jail for protesting the U.S. policy of drone strikes. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The Ecuadorian government is considering the implication of finally expelling the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, according to local media. Online editions of the El Telégrafo and El Ciudadano newspapers said that foreign ministry officials met recently with representatives of the Technical Department for International Cooperation to discuss the repercussions of an eventual decision on the matter. Local media reports said that if the authorities finally decide to expel the U.S. agency, Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa could make the official announcement sometime this week. According to the sources, of an additional $10.2 million U.S. dollars sent to Ecuador by USAID in 2010, only $4 million were earmarked for social programs. El Telégrafo newspaper says that USAID interference in Ecuador seeks to end an ongoing framework agreement which is of strategic importance for the South American country, which has not been renewed so far. In the past few weeks, El Telégrafo revealed that USAID is funding two projects in Ecuador worth 4.3 million US dollars, allegedly to strengthen democracy. The newspaper warns that with these resources, they seek to lead a joint campaign using the country's civil society organizations that opposed the government of Rafael Correa during this electoral year, and against Decree 982, which regulates the activities of non-governmental organizations. Since May 2010, Rafael Correa has been disclosing the existence of a considerable number of NGOs in the country, mainly uncontrolled and failing to pay taxes, which receive funding to carry out illegal political activities.
Supporters of ousted Paraguayan President Fernando Lugo demanded the annulment of his impeachment and his reinstatement. After covering the main streets of Asunción, the capital, they gathered outside the headquarters of the public TV station, the scene of other protests against the parliamentary coup of June the 23rd. The new protest against the government appointed by Congress following Lugo's ouster coincided with the visit to Paraguay of the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, José Miguel Insulza. On Monday, the OAS chief met both with Federico Franco, head of the coup government, and Lugo, and then continued his program of scheduled meetings with the leaders of both houses of Congress and representatives of political parties. According to news reports from Asunción, the only important public statement made by Insulza since his arrival to Asunción was about his acknowledgement of the difficult situation facing the South American nation and a sort of promise he to consider the issue during the upcoming plenary meeting of the OAS Permanent Council. The mass meeting in support of Lugo coincided with similar activities and mobilizations called by workers in other Paraguayan provinces, especially those in the east of the country, and in the border areas with Argentina and Brazil.
Three peace activists appeared in court today following their arrest last week outside the Hancock Field Air National Guard base near Syracuse, New York. The three were among 15 people jailed last week for protesting U.S. drone attacks, but they remain behind bars for non-compliance with their sentencing requirements under a conviction for a previous anti-drone protest earlier this year. During last Thursday's action, the protesters displayed images of young victims of U.S. drone strikes as they blocked the base's main entrance.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 1 to 2 p.m. at 11760 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6060, 6050, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 6 p.m. to midnight at www.radiohc.cu and podcasting at World Radio Network, wrn.org. On to the Voice of Russia. The cause of the death of former Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in 2004 has been questioned following laboratory findings of polonium on his belongings. The Voice of Russia.
New astonishing findings emerged concerning the mysterious death of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in 2004. According to the assessment of laboratory research carried out in Switzerland, the longtime Palestinian leader and Nobel Peace Prize laureate died of polonium poisoning. Al Jazeera reported on Tuesday that a 9-month-old investigation by the Institute of Radiation Physics at the University of Lausanne uncovered abnormal levels of the radioactive substance polonium on Arafat's belongings.
Arafat died in a French military hospital aged 75, just weeks following an onset of a mysterious illness. He was described as relatively healthy before. After falling ill, the Palestinian leader was flown from his headquarters in Palestine to a hospital in Paris. Some observers suggested the unidentified condition could have been AIDS, cancer, or cirrhosis of the liver, but that was never confirmed.
At the time, Palestinian authorities accused longtime foe Israel of using its spy agency Mossad to poison Arafat with thallium, another radioactive element. However, no traces of the heavy metal or any conventional poisons were found in his system during the initial Palestinian investigation. French authorities refused to name the precise cause of Arafat's death, citing privacy laws.
According to François Bouchou, head of the Lausanne Institute, the analysis focused on biological samples taken from Arafat's belongings, given to his wife Suha by the hospital staff after his death. The belongings tested, including Arafat's clothes, his toothbrush, and even his famous kefir, which contained traces of his blood, sweat, saliva, and urine. Dr. Bushu told Al Jazeera, the conclusion was that we did find some significant polonium that was present in these samples.
The shocking findings prompted Arafat's widow, Suha Arafat, to ask the Palestinian Authority to exhume Arafat's body from his grave in Ramallah in order to conduct more tests. If the subsequent analysis shows elevated levels of polonium in Arafat's bones, this would be further evidence that the late leader was murdered.
Bushu said regarding the possibility of further testing, if Suha Arafat really wants to know what happened to her husband, we need to find a sample. I mean, an exhumation should provide us with a sample that should have a very high quantity of polonium if he was poisoned. In addition, because polonium's half-life is only 138 days, Arafat's level of radiation at the time of his death was 2 million times higher.
Polonium is a rare and highly radioactive element with limited commercial use. Polonium rose to notoriety in 2006 when it was used to kill former Russian spy and asylum seeker Alexander Litvinenko in a sushi restaurant in central London. 43-year-old Litvinenko, who is said to have drunk tea laced with radioactive isotope polonium-210, suffered from severe diarrhea, weight loss, and vomiting, culminating in a slow and agonizing death, all symptoms similar to those of Arafat.
Arafat's widow commented on the findings by saying, "We got into this very, very painful conclusion, but at least this removes this great burden on me. At least I've done something to explain to the Palestinian people, to the Arab and Muslim generation all over the world, that it was not a natural death, it was a crime."
There are very few recorded cases of polonium poisoning, and there is no consensus on what exactly its symptoms are. According to Al Jazeera, two people connected with Israel's nuclear program have also died from the exposure to polonium in the late 1950s and 60s. It has also been suggested that the daughter of Marie Curie and Pierre Curie, the pair of French scientists who discovered the element, have died from the radiation effects of polonium.
Polonium is often described as an ideal poison because it's hard to detect and needs to be swallowed by the victim to have any effect. It doesn't penetrate the skin, so it can be handled by the assassin without much risk. A tiny amount of polonium is enough to kill a person, but even the smallest amount is very hard for anyone outside of the nuclear industry to procure.
Russian exports about 8 grams per month to the U.S., its sole buyer, with a single gram selling for about $2 million. The International Atomic Energy Agency monitors the sale of the element and has registered numerous cases of illegal trade in radioactive substances. However, there are no confirmed cases of polonium theft.
According to Hervik Peretsky of the National Research Center for Environment and Health in Neuherberg, an assassin with a lot of time on his or her hands can derive polonium from uranium, and there are even books on how this can be done. This, however, is a slow and difficult process which produces only insignificant quantity of polonium. It is almost a given that the polonium used to assassinate Arafat and Litvinenko came from a nuclear reactor. The only question is which one and who took it.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 11 at 15-425-9800 and 9665 or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production costs of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Please support independently produced radio. Donations are the only source of funding for this weekly program. We will conclude with NHK World Radio Japan. An insight on questions surrounding the restart of the Oi nuclear power plant in Japan, which has seen significant protest by citizens who want to cease nuclear power on the island. NHK.
In today's insight, we take up some questions surrounding the Oi nuclear plant's restart. We speak with NHK's senior commentator, Noriyuki Mizuno. What sort of safeguards are we seeing at the reactor from plant operator Kansai Electric Power Company and the government?
The authorities are implementing unusually strict measures because this is the first restart since the nuclear disaster began at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. The utility, or KEPCO, has been preparing the restart very carefully. It called in workers from other nuclear plants to attend preparations at Oi and increase the number of checks. The government has doubled the number of Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency inspectors. The inspectors have been stationed at the plant's central control room to closely monitor the process. All this gives the impression that efforts have been increased. Even so, there have been problems and errors of judgment. And given these troubles, it's hard to believe the parties involved are serious enough about safety. For example, soon after preparations for the restart began, a drop in the water level inside a power generator set off an alarm. But it was half a day later that officials at the agency and KEPCO disclosed there had been a problem. The reason they gave was that they considered the incident a minor issue that didn't warrant reporting. But since it happened at a time of extreme concern among many residents, it drew a lot of criticism from local municipalities. So no matter how minor the trouble may be, in order to address public concerns, the government and KEPCO should announce in detail what actually happened. I believe that without such a stance, public trust in nuclear power will never be restored.
Not all safety measures at Oi plant have been implemented yet, is that right?
Exactly. The government claims that even if an earthquake or tsunami as severe as the ones that hit Fukushima occur, a reactor core meltdown will not happen. The reason, they say, is the implementation of steps that can quickly be taken, such as reinforcing the power supply and starting pumps. But measures that take more time to complete, such as constructing a quake-resistant administration building, are not yet in place, and no assessment has been made as to whether the plant can withstand disasters other than earthquake or tsunami, and what may happen if it comes under terrorist attack. Efforts to review plans to evacuate residents and boost anti-disaster preparedness are still not complete. I would say the Oi reactors are about to be restarted at a time when measures to minimise disaster in the event of a reactor core meltdown have not yet been worked out.
It seems that strict monitoring to ensure the reactor's safety will be vital.
That's correct. A new Nuclear Regulatory Commission is expected to play that role, and a law to set it up was enacted in June. But who will make up the body hasn't been decided yet. It's estimated it will take some time before the commission is launched, and that's fueling concerns from people who think the restart is too early. The Fukushima nuclear disaster has raised public awareness about the magnitude of risks, so a new regulatory system must be established as soon as possible.
In today's Insight, we spoke with NHK's senior commentator Noriyuki Mizuno about the restart at the Oi nuclear plant.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 10 p.m. to 10:30 at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast. You could use a shortwave radio at home, which is far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.